Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Our early pro football team highlighted in this edition is one from Connecticut, spearheaded by a very interesting owner and promoter. It's the story of the Hartford Blues and their rise in brief time in the NFL, and their story is coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And as we look back in that portal of football history today, we are going to look at one of the early professional teams of the early NFL, actually in the first 5 or 6 years of the NFL, the Hartford Blues. But before we do that, let's take care of a few housekeeping things. First of all, we want to make sure you know about how to subscribe to our email newsletter. A couple different ways you can do that. You can go on PigskinDispatch.com. Go to email subscription up near the top banner. Click on that. There's two fields you have to fill out, and you will be getting every day at 6:30 a.m. getting our email with a newsletter of everything that's going on at Pigskin Dispatch, the Sports Jersey Dispatch, both podcasts, three podcasts, Orville Mulligan included, and some items that are coming on with our friends at the Sports History Network as far as sports history. It's a great way to get your day started off and get you right into some great sports history and podcasts and articles. Another way to do that is you can go to www.pigskindispatch.com/lowercase letter I, capital U, capital G, for that email newsletter. And or you can go to the show notes of this podcast and click on the link there. Also, you can follow us on Twitter at Pigskin Dispatch and Facebook. We have the Pigskin Dispatch pages. You can email us at pigskindispatch@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback on this and all of our articles and podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. So let's talk a little bit about these Hartford Blues. You know, one team that we really haven't talked a lot about. The history of the Hartford Blues starts off with the story of its founder, George Mulligan. Now, Mulligan was probably the most renowned promoter of sports and sporting events in Connecticut during the 1920s era. Mulligan came to the area at the age of 5 when his family immigrated from the country of England, and he grew up to know the lay of the land and recognize that hardworking people of the region would spend their extra coins to watch live sporting events. You know, industries were growing up in the area, and they were very diverse in that region of the country. You had the insurance companies of the city of Hartford, the brass mills of the town of Waterbury, and the hardware factories of New Britain. They were all pretty much geographically close to each other. And what a better way to get their minds off their daily toils than to look on as the talented athletes who compete for their town against opponents from towns around the country. In the 1920s, these workers supported the sporting events of choice, semi-pro football teams that played high-level competition with former big-name college players as the draw. Now, George Mulligan established his first gridiron squad called the Waterbury Blues. The process that Mulligan used was pretty well established by other teams in the Northeast. First, he would hire on local talent from schools and sandlot teams and then practice on Sunday mornings shortly before game time, as this was the only chance he could get all of his players assembled when they weren't working their day jobs or doing some other family obligations. Now, the formula proved worthy, as in 1924, the Waterbury Blues were the top team in Connecticut. Mulligan had his sights on making the football team the best around, though, and he continued by hiring the best local talent that Connecticut and other nearby New England areas could provide so as to build one of the best in 1924 football teams in the Northeast. Now, he targeted big-name collegiate players that had recently graduated. His main objective in 1925 was to sign Harry Stoldreyer, the quarterback of the Notre Dame 1924 Four Horsemen fame. Now, Stoldreyer at first did not accept Mulligan's offer to play for the Blues. The famous back had offers from all over the place, including rivals New Britain, as well as a very well-established Providence Steamroller in Rhode Island. Stoldreyer first accepted the Providence offer and even played a game there. It was the Steamroller's inaugural season in the NFL, and Providence played a warm-up non-league contest against the West Point Artillery Club, in which Stoldreyer played. Now, Providence greatly outmatched the West Point team by a score of 127-0. And Stoldreyer, figuring that he was the key to the high-powered offense of the Steamroller attack, asked his employer for more money. When the Providence manager refused to offer something satisfactory to his quarterback, Stoldreyer looked again for other options. Enter again the opportunity-seeking sports promotion mind of George Mulligan, who really sweetened the pot in making the former Irish player's salary to be $7,500 plus $500 in bonus money. Well, Stoldreyer immediately signed onto this lucrative deal and jumped ship to play with the Waterbury Blues. Now, a couple of other former Newt Rockne players also joined the fray too. Ed Hunsinger, who signed on with Mulligan's roster and rejoined former Irish teammate Stoldreyer as an end in Waterbury. Art Garvey, a big strong tackle, had played pro ball for 7 years since leaving the Notre Dame Fighting Irish in 1922. He had received some all-league mention as a member of the Chicago Bears in 1923. And Waterbury's other top backs at the start of the 1925 season were Ken Simminger of Holy Cross and Dutch Forst from Villanova. Another lineman, Dick McGrath, doubled as a captain and a coach, and the nucleus of a strong core team was built for that 1925 season. Now, surrounding towns were starting to deploy strong opposition semi-pro football as well. The areas of New Britain, Hartford, Norwalk, and New London each had formidable squads, but only the New Britain and Hartford teams had the talented roster enough firepower to really compete with the Waterbury Blues. Now, the Coffin Corner magazine of the PFRA in a 1982 article by John Hogrogian says, quote, "All New Britain had rivaled Waterbury for years on an almost even keel. They had a seasoned roster of local players featuring fullback Ed Barlenkow and a non-college workhorse from Meriden and a quarterback Vic Razendvich and a University of Connecticut graduate from Torrington," unquote. Now, Mulligan had his sights set on having a strong season in 1925, so much so that he could possibly have his team be awarded an NFL franchise for 1926. Well, the 25 season started out strong too, as the Waterbury Blues dispatched a Yonkers team 32-0, followed up with a victory in the next game by defeating Hartford 7-3. The momentum for the season and the fan excitement really grew when Mulligan announced the signing of yet another famous Notre Dame horseman, Jim Crowley. The next opponent from Adams, Massachusetts, took the punishment from the brutal Blues attack. The Waterbury flexed their muscles by running off to a 34-0 victory over the undermatched Adams 11, with Crowley scoring 3 touchdowns and Stoldreyer booting 2 field goals and 3 extra points. However, Crowley, after the game, grabbed his game pay and headed for greener pastures, giving the Blues a fair goodbye. Now, the Hartford Westsiders team that had earlier had preseason hopes of contending dashed right after the heartbreaking loss to Waterbury. They lost their next match, which was a close one to New Britain, their other rival. Coach Dave Hayes and others tried to rally the Westside 11, but to no avail. With such a lackadaisical performance against the New Britons, Hayes and owner Russell McIntosh fired each and every player on the squad. And with that, they did not play another game after they tried to restructure the roster. Well, they did play one more game. We'll talk about that in a second. Mulligan, again seeing opportunity, started looking into having some home games moved to Hartford since he believed the Westsiders may no longer be using the Clarkin Field as reported by the Hartford Courier. But there was still a Westsiders team. The Blues in mid-October faced a staunch challenge against the Rochester Jeffersons and again prevailed 7-6 over the Jeffs of Leo Lyons. On November 1st, the Blues dispatched a team from Newark 26-0. Meanwhile, that same day in New Jersey, the reorganized Westsiders again took the field, that Hartford 11, and mostly there was a new group of players that traveled to New Britain and lost again to New Britain 3-0. After that game, the Westsiders simply threw in a towel, and George Mulligan immediately picked up the lease on the Clarkin Field, and riding high on a string of victories, the Waterbury Blues were renamed mid-season to become the Hartford Blues. Reports indicated that poor support from Waterbury is what led to the venue change. And it's also reported that Mulligan had negotiated a deal and paid for the Hartford Blues to have a franchise place in the NFL for the 1926 season. Well, the Hartford Blues officially played their first game with their new name in a rematch game with Rochester, in which they again succeeded in a narrow 8-6 win over the Jeffs. And it wasn't as wonderful as it sounds, though, as the poor, cool, rainy weather provided a disappointing crowd of only 2,000 in their new city, and their star player Stuhldreher suffered a mild concussion during the game. This set up a showdown at Clarkin Field the following week against New Britain, who had some new life given to them with a recent signing of former Providence steamroller player, halfback Dutch Connors. The Blues went into the game undefeated, but the contest was hard fought. A still groggy Stuhldreher was limited by the New Britain defensive strategy, and the Blues' other star back, Simminger, suffered a season-ending injury in the midst of the contest. Final score in a rain-soaked field, New Britain 6, Hartford nothing, their first loss. With that victory, New Britain was prematurely claiming their rights to the state championship, but Hartford pointed to a rematch scheduled for November 29th. The next games for each of those two teams gave way to wins for each of them. On Thanksgiving Day, the Blues didn't schedule a game because of a number of key players not being available, including Stuhldreher, because remember, he was still coaching for a high school team in the area. And the all-New Britain team had a formidable foe when they traveled to Philadelphia and lost a 7-0 decision to the Yellow Jackets of the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. And even though his team was not playing during the holiday, Mulligan was still hard at work. He booked a coveted NFL game where the defending league champions, the Cleveland Bulldogs, would play the Kansas City Cowboys at Clarkin Field to give the Hartford fans a glimpse of NFL competition that was forthcoming. NFL President Joe Carr sanctioned that match abruptly as an official league contest. And with that, the NFL had arrived in Hartford a year before the Blues were officially members. Kansas City defeated Cleveland handily in a great game. You know, Cleveland was a little bit weakened from their championship season of a year before. 17-0 Kansas City was that game, and it was a Cowboys' final game of the 1925 season. And with that, Mulligan went to work again, as he almost immediately signed some new players. Some, they even played for the Kansas City Cowboys to the Hartford roster. Other new team members were added too, such as halfback Don Miller, who was the third horseman from Notre Dame to sign a contract with Mulligan. With the revamped roster and rematch with the all-New Britain loomed, a large turnout of over 7,000 fans watched out on at Clarkin Field to witness the Blues whip New Britain 28-7. This was just days after New Britain got beaten by the Frankfurt 11. Maybe it was too close of a game in between games, not enough time to recover from that disappointing loss to Frankfurt, as New Britain team seemed to be very little fight in them in that game against Hartford. Regardless, the reinforced Blues dominated and ensured its claim on a state championship title. Mulligan then watched as his team defeated the Pere Marquette Knights, and his best team in Boston, who followed another W against St. Alphonsus, another team from Beantown. In the finale of the year, the Cleveland Bulldogs returned to Hartford, and Mulligan really promoted this game, and subsequently he signed the remaining members of the Four Horsemen to play in the Hartford backfield. The Hartford Current speculated that Mulligan might be paying $5,000 each for the one-day services of Stuhldreher, Miller, Crowley, and Elmer Layden. And despite the talent of the Blues climbing a notch into the reunion of the Notre Dame backfield, this trip to Hartford ended in a 13-6 victory for the Cleveland Bulldogs over the Blues. And this wrapped up the great season, with the Blues finishing at 10-2. And next up was the NFL season of 1926. And we'll get back to that right after this message.
The memorable moments were many. Franco Harris's immaculate reception, Roger Staubach's Hail Mary. But the decade's greatest teams were defined by defense. Author Michael McCambridge. Joe Zagorski's podcast, Pro Football in the 1970s, pays homage to a time when defense ruled the gridiron. Soundtrack provided by Horst Hoffman of filmmusic.io.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
That's a great program. Make sure you check that one out if you love football history. Now let's get back to the Hartford Blues. And remember, they finished the season of 1925 as sort of an independent at 10-2, but they were joining the NFL in 1926. And with playing in the NFL, Mulligan decided to change the home venue for the Blues for the third time in a year. It was a brand new stadium at the East Hartford Velodrome. That velodrome, that sounds familiar. Well, that's a bicycle track. It was just across the Connecticut River in East Hartford. The velodrome was an oval with about 8,000 seats around the banked wooden track for the bicyclers to ride on. However, there was just enough room inside that wooden track to present a football field that was 100 yards long. On the personnel front, unfortunately for Mulligan and Hartford, Layden and Stuhldreher left the team to join the Brooklyn Horsemen of the American Football League. That's the original American Football League of the Red Grange era. Now, Hartford began their inaugural 1926 NFL season on a sour note with a 21-0 loss to the New York Giants. The team later added two losses in back-to-back games against the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets and a 6-0 loss to the Brooklyn Lions at Ebbets Field. The team would go on to only win three games during the season, and they were all sort of right in a row. They won against the Brooklyn Lions 16-6. The Dayton Triangles, they defeated 16-0, and the Canton Bulldogs, they won over with a 16-7 score in a game that ended bitterly due to the darkness and lack of field lights at that venue. The rest of the season was like the lights were still out for Hartford as they suffered four more losses. The Kansas City Cowboys, Buffalo Bisons, and a barnstorming Duluth Eskimos all won over the Blues. Just to add insult to injury, New Britain, in a non-league tilt, outlasted the Hartford 11, and it was a disappointing 3-7 record in the big league, their inaugural and only year in the National Football League. So after such a successful 1925 independent season at 10-2, the Blues entered their disappointing 1926 year in the NFL after the season and returned to being an independent for the 1927 season, playing one more season as the Hartford Giants before folding the franchise forever. So the dream of having a professional football team in the NFL for George Mulligan, it did take place, and he did have a good team the year before they went in, but just didn't have a whole lot of luck in the NFL and sort of lost that fan support that's so much needed, especially in a smaller market like Hartford, as opposed to, you know, the bigger cities. So that's the history of the Hartford Blues. We're sure glad that you were able to join us here with that today. Hope you'll join us tomorrow for some more great football history. Remember, we'd love to hear your feedback, pigskindispatch@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Pigskin Dispatch. Till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.